The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
Today's show, we're having back on here Karen Ward, drug policy advisor at the City of Vancouver, harm reduction advocate and longtime Downtown Eastside artist and activist, to talk about the latest overdose statistic. 1,715 people died last year, a historic record, hundreds more than any previous year, largely caused by changes to the supply during the pandemic. But there have been some signs of hope, including four pilot projects launched for a safer drug supply, as well as Vancouver's moves to call for decriminalization of possession. Karen, hey, it's great to have you back on Co-op Radio.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing today?
Oh, it's been a weird day. It was whatever day it was yesterday, so everything's backwards.
I feel like for a year now, it's whatever day it was yesterday plus one.
It's Blur's Day the 20th.
Karen, you've been so involved on Twitter, and you're really trying to build alliances for harm reduction and safe supply. Tell me what's going on.
It's day 1,770th of the boring old crisis here. One must realize that this is not the sort of, like I said before, it's a complicated mess, and we're not going to get any of these big pieces moving until we've got broad support from across the public. And if we're serious with the idea that actually everyone uses drugs, but some are illegal, and some people can use any drug they want, but they're not criminalized. And then we see those sorts of things happening, and that actually makes us stronger, you know. And then as more and more of the public, like talking to each other isn't going to help at a certain point, but talking out into the broader public and bringing in people into this conversation is actually this is where we're at.
Nope. There's a lot of ignorance and stigma out there. Do you find that draining, like having conversations with people?
It is draining, yeah. It is draining.
Because some people don't value people's lives in the same way.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's part of the thing, is that they don't value people's lives because they don't see them as people. They don't see us as having full humanity. That's the basis of not having to care. You know, you're not human. Why should I? It's really tough, honestly. It can be really crushing. Even last week when it was a coroner's day, the big day, you know, you try to expect it to be tough, but you really can't insulate yourself from it.
And that was the day that we finally got last year's overdose stats, which unsurprisingly showed that we had a record high number of deaths from toxic poison drugs, 1,713.
Yeah, we knew that. We knew we did. That was not a big surprise of any sort. And I mean, that's not the fact that there's more is more than even, you know, in 2017 and 2018, unimaginably terrible years, even more than that, by hundreds, not by 10, by hundreds. We knew this. We knew this was coming. Everyone did. If you had any, you paying any attention at all, which I know that people aren't. There's all kinds of other fun public health emergencies. Anyways, the point being that, you know, there's this lack of understanding of what's happening. When you take a monthly report or you take a yearly report, you say, "Whoa, it's news." Didn't you notice all the bodies dropping all year long, in massive numbers everywhere in the province? Did you actually not notice that? I mean, that's actually tougher than anything else. It's to pretend this is some sort of new information. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
Pretending it is worse.
We knew that the year was on track to be the worst ever in March or April.
Well, yeah. I mean, exactly. I mean, we were saying this then. And I mean, the thing is that this isn't something that happens all this time. It's cumulative. This has a history. This is the result of choices that we make. This isn't a virus that is, you know, that arises in the natural world from time to time throughout history, just because that happens. This isn't an earthquake. This isn't a flood. This is something that was made by human choices over many years. Everyone is culpable. It's good because you're responsible and able to change it. We can't actually prevent viruses before they happen, but we don't have to do this. And the thing is, I read this just last week. Frederick Engels, Marx's buddy, he had his book, which I hadn't read, but it's about the working class in England in 1845. And he talks about this thing. He's like, the owners and the rich and the Catholics, they're killing these people. Well, somebody said they're not actually killing them. And then he came up with this idea, this concept called social murder. And it's when we mean the same, like we call it maybe structural violence. No, social murder. When the oppressing class makes it impossible for you to live. To live a full life, and in fact to live at all. They killed you as much as they had with a knife, and that's a forgotten kind of concept that we can bring right back. It says very clearly what's happening here, and it explains very well. Like this past weekend, like that's why we have the Murdered and Missing Women's March, the Indigenous women. That's what structural violence is. It's being murdered and missing as a verb. It's being taken away. That's social murder.
You know, this reminds me of a quote from anthropologist David Graeber, who passed away last year. The ultimate hidden truth of the world is that it is something that we make and could just as easily make differently.
That's right. Naturalize, it's like the thing with police. How could we can't live without, the police are a very recent human invention. You know, and this is important to recognize because we've had there are all these kinds of things that are natural because otherwise they're inexcusable, right? It's this twisted up thing, and it plays off of our lack of understanding and our misunderstanding of how power actually works. It actually builds realities. That's the whole point, right? It's just so insidious. Here, I want to read you a quote, if I could, David.
Please go ahead.
Okay, you're going to like this one. It's Paul Goodman. He was an anarchist in the late 60s, and I'm sure, and he wrote about a book called Community of Scholars about cooperative schools, education, things like that. So here's a quote from him from some other book. He says, an immense and indispensable advantage of history or poetry is that it continually presents to us many other possible human ways of being, which might have other arrangements, communication, and patterns. Which is to say, right, it doesn't have to be this way. None of this does. We made it ourselves.
That's powerful. Thank you. So how do you have these conversations, Karen, with people who sometimes, are starting from a place where they're dehumanizing or don't even see value in another person? How do you get them to see that, or do you walk away and find someone who's maybe a little more slightly sympathetic?
Well, sometimes I just walk away, honestly. But usually there's a connection. If there's at least a conversation happening, if someone's just not like screaming at me or insulting, whatever. If someone's trying to have a conversation, we've made that connection and that effort is there. That's somewhere to go. Sometimes it's like, In different, I've found some of the most effective conversations have been over, there's videos around that people make. People make art, Smokey's work, Trey's work, all this sort of thing. The music, things that people make and do, usually creative, that is an assertion about, if nothing else, it could be anything, any kind of creative work at all. What it says at its core is, I'm human. And that's good place to start. That's a great place to start because it leaps over that whole discussion. And having, I've had to do that experience where, I have to go talk at this thing about such and such and convince them of this. And it's like, oh no, I've got to take 1 minute at the beginning to tell them I'm human before I start or else, it sucks. But you've got to figure out, because it's so unconscious that they just don't. They start talking to you in the third person while you're standing in front of them. It's stuff like that. It's brutal. And you get you down. So, but then you start to strategize past it, I guess. I prefer to think of how I do things as being, kind of over the top rather than, getting into these endless debates. These endless debates are such a waste of time. My God.
Now, I wanted to ask you something because there's a debate happening within the substance use community over how whose voices get prominent in the work of destigmatizing drugs. And I remember what sparked it recently was this Guardian profile of a Columbia University professor who came out as a heroin user and showed how he was like a normal professional pact paying guy. And a lot of people jumped on that and said, this is not actually helping because then you allow the dehumanization of people down the economic ladder who are deeply traumatized, what do you think of this? Is there a place for this? Is it problematic? What do you think?
It kind of makes sense that like the Guardian does actually profile a fair number of university professors. That's kind of their thing, right? But I'd like to see and one of his core things in his book is which I've read several things about and talked, but the is if you are a drug user with any kind of privilege, as he is, just cut out, right? I mean, make it easier for other people to get to survive by coming out and speak publicly about what needs to be done, because silencing is what's killing us. And in many ways, that's a very similar message to the AIDS crisis, and to how that emerged into a queer rights movement. And so there's a parallel there. And he's saying, come out if you've got any privilege or power to do so. If saying you're a drug user is going to crush you and destroy your life, maybe not right now, right? Because that's how power works. But I think that's the takeaway. From that, media appearance, certainly, and incidentally, it's a hell of a book, too, but that media appearance was about, I think, about talking about ways to make space. So I don't have a problem with that at all. I think it's a really brilliant way to do it, and a clever way, too. I am frustrated by these endless internal debates, because what we need to do is have them in public. We really, really do. Because man, we're getting crushed. We do need to start talking instead of with it. We have to open the gates and talk in the world. Otherwise, we're never going to get past criminalization and stigmatization unless people see us for who we are.
Also, not to mention, that it's surviving is a miracle in our current drug market.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And I think that, and I think that talking about that, what that takes, incidentally, is really necessary. Like that work, and it's hard work, of people who stand up and tell their stories is necessary, very necessary. What it is to survive right now, what it's been like to survive, these must be told. And I would encourage everyone who's remotely interested in doing that and thinks they might want to try, please get in touch. Because there's lots of ways to do that, not just with words, but with other kinds of ways of expressing oneself. This is so important, and it's badly needed. And by the way, you're going to stand taller and speak louder when you start doing it, so I highly recommend it. That's important, but we need to start encouraging each other to start taking those steps about speaking out and being public. What's the opposite of criminalized? It's decriminalized. Okay, but that's a negative definition, right? We're just not what we were. Well, what is that? We don't know, right? So we've got to figure out where we're going. Do we want to try to be in the world? Maybe. I don't know. And it's not for anybody to say how it should be. But we need to start figuring that out in a positive sense. Like, that is to say, not a. It's not this, it's not that. We've got to figure out what it will be.
There's a motto in the science fiction post-apocalyptic book that I love by Emily St. John Mandel. It's called Station 11. And one of the mottos of this group of artists in the post-apocalyptic world in Canada and the States is survival is insufficient. Like, it wasn't enough to survive the apocalypse. What are you creating?
Exactly. Survival is not enough. And that's, I mean, that resonates a bit, because you remember Dashé's old motto was a Yoko Ono quote, art is a means of survival. And it's also like, well, it's more than that. Obviously, you wouldn't, it's way more than that. And, there used to be a nonprofit group in the neighborhood, and it was called LINES, LINES, which stood for Life is Not Enough.
Great to drop some Yoko Ono references in our program. I'm really happy about that.
Oh, no problem. Anytime, no. No problem. Well, that's a gaucher thing, too. And it's just like, it's just interesting because we do want more. Obviously, if people didn't want more, why would we bother with overdose prevention, right? Like, they do, and that's the thing. People need to, people have been so put down that they've, but I know that they, I know it's there. They've been put down. They're not sure that they can be all that they are, or they don't remember, or they haven't tried, but they can. You know, I was saying the other day, drug users work their asses off, and, you know, nobody knows that. Nobody knows their business like that, like we do. And it's just time to go into the world. Come on, guys. We can, you know, and I know they can. I know people can. People are great. So, like, we've got to just bust out of this shell. Unfortunately, there's a pandemic, but we've got to find some ways.
There's a project the Globe and Mail just did, a full multi-page spread where they profiled hundreds and hundreds of families who lost loved ones to the poisoned toxic drug supply. And I thought what was powerful, two things, was that according to the author, Andrea Wu, so many families are now wanting to talk, and the stigma has lifted for so many, like the almost all of them compared to earlier. And also that it was the spectrum of drug users. It was recreational, it was upper class, it was poor, it was traumatized, it was people on the margins, people at the center.
And that's the thing that people forget. I mean, obviously, everyone's very self, always worried about themselves, but it just happens when you're in survival mode. But the fact is, even in BC, like 40% of those people who died did not use compulsively. They use once a month or twice a year or something like that, just for fun, now and then, at a show, or you know, but we all die the same death. And this is this is something I can point to lately because, you know, it's actually not criminal or health issue. Much more complicated, right? There's a huge range of human experiences, and, you know, and drugs are not just an answer to a problem, but they also make you feel good. And people do need that. And that's one of the things I've had on the back of my mind with COVID is like people are definitely going to want that if we get through this. You know, people have a lot of stress. I'm worried about people who don't use and then need to use something and just need to take an edge off because there's nothing but death out here, you know, and we've got to do something about this because I'm so worried about these people.
I wanted to talk about some of the big changes in the last couple of months, Karen, because we've had huge ones and haven't had a chance to talk to you about them since January. One of them is this pilot announcement, tens of millions of dollars from the federal government for 4 pilot projects on safer supply production of drugs. So you see that as a game changer, right?
Oh, it could be. I hope so. I hope it is. I'm going to like hassle them. Hopefully, you know, it'll be transformative. I mean, one is already up and going in Victoria. That's been going for about a year, I think. And it's some photos. It's outreach. Like they've been struggling. They found a way to get through the snow in Victoria to get people their drugs. Like stuff like that, even, you know, so it's mostly people who are in the kind of trying to figure, like, they're housed, unhoused, not sure what's happening kind of thing. There's a lot of, it's a bit of a chaotic, it's not chaotic, but people are moving around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They're unsteady addresses, but they're managing, but every day they're steady on the supply, which is remarkable. So that's great. They got a boost that's going to guarantee them at least 3 more years of funding. And then there's the project down here. There's one is an indigenous-led pilot. I don't know a ton of the details, but I know a few of the nurses involved.
And that's huge because of the huge disproportionate death toll for indigenous peoples in BC compared to other populations.
One problem, if I could just to be a little bit nuanced about it, is that it's a disproportionate number of the population, but we don't know where. It's really frustrating. The data is really frustrating because we don't actually get race-based data until we hear from FNHA.
That's the First Nations Health Authority, and they do provincial-wide authority.
That's right. All we know, though, is that the people were in the province. We don't know if they lived in the city or in up north. There's no information for that. It makes it difficult to, it actually gives the government an excuse not to properly resource Indigenous-led harm reduction, which is the problem. Because there should be equity, urban and rural, and remote, whatever, and there should be equity between, of course. So that's a big problem, again, and that's the government saying, we did a shit job, so we can't do a job, ha-ha. You know, so it's just, it's really a bites you in the ass. And then our, like our, and it's estimated to be around 16% of people suffering a fatal overdose in the first 6 months of the year were indigenous, whereas 6% of the population is.
Yeah, that's wild, tragic, and horrible.
It's even worse to say that of that population, the, you know, indigenous women are disproportionately represented.
That's right. We talked to FMHA's medical director, and they said it was the exact opposite for the rest of the population's overdose stats, where it's mostly men.
That's right. It's 80% men in the rest of the population, whereas it's the opposite. And that, and we know, and they, once again, we've known this for years. This is not a big revelation, you know, but nobody gives a shit. Nobody cares. And this is something that happens one day. And that's that sort of media cycle. But it's been, and you can see that fact, and you're like, look, it's structural violence. Look, right there. Right there. And it, like, I don't know, it can't be more obvious.
It's also a big reminder of the link between trauma, adverse childhood events, intergenerational colonialism, and its role in so much substance use. Not all, but a lot.
And let's remember, too, the report earlier this year, or was it late last year? It doesn't matter. About racism against anti-Indigenous racism in the healthcare system in BC. Because what is using drugs but the fact that you never got a proper diagnosis and you never had a decent doctor and you never went to see it, you know, all that sort of stuff? You're using medicine on the street because you don't have other medicines. You don't have a medical system that you can trust. That's what it is about in many, many cases. Like many, many people have like, we've talked about that at length. And I do remind you as well that there's a big research paper about this, experiences of Indigenous people in Indigenous healthcare settings that was done several years ago by WARS. They led the research and developed the project itself.
The Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society.
Yeah. And I mean, this is something that, and this is a, you know, and that's, and so the other problem with that is, of course, it's people say, oh, you're self-medicating. It's like, well, yeah, of course. I go, yes. You know, it's medicine.
Is there anything that you're going to be watching for, either from these pilot projects or from the different levels of government, that you want it to work, that you think needs to be attended to ensure this actually achieves its goals?
Yes. Well, I think that in all cases, the people who get enrolled or participating in whatever in these projects need to find a way to start, like, to have basically a patient association, you know, not unlike what Dave Murray did with Salome and Naomi Projects. Have a patient, you do patient advocacy. You stand up for yourself. You say, no, we want this. We want this to work. Like, and you learn how to do your own self-advocacy starting within the context of the program that you're in. How else do you make things work for the people involved? You fight for them. You put the pressure on. You work with the doctor. If you feel powerless because you're up to the doctor, well, that's fine. Let's get organized. Let's have a group of people going and working out these issues collectively. That's the way to do it. We've learned that. We don't need to relearn that. So let's just do it, and let's facilitate it by making sure people have a space to work in. That's all.
Speaking of learnings, Karen, we're coming up to 1 year since the pandemic was declared, and I'm wondering, is there one thing that you've learned over the last year that you want to carry forward in your life?
What have I learned about emergencies? No, I think I've learned that. I guess I've learned that it's good to stick with things. Maybe. I guess so. I don't know. It's been. I mean, if I think too much about it, everything gets really miserable. But I guess I've learned that it's not that. It's maybe a positive thing to be very stubborn about stuff. I don't know. I don't know what. I mean, I don't want to keep doing this. I want to figure out a way to get through things, I guess.
Because survival is insufficient.
Survival sucks. Yeah. I want a lot more.
Karen, thank you so much for being with us. It's so wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Davis. Thanks for talking, as always.
I always enjoy our conversations. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye. And that was Karen Ward, a drug policy advisor with the City of Vancouver and downtown Eastside artist and activist.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.